Hi, welcome to another edition of the PCRF podcasts. My name is Dave Page, and I am here with
Dr. Aaron Burnett. I'm a pre-hospital medicine fellow with Regents Hospital EMS in St. Paul, Minnesota.
And I'm Keith Wesley. I'm the medical director for Health East Medical Transportation here in St. Paul.
And Marshall Washick, paramedic with Health East Medical Transportation.
We're going to talk about three different papers, three research papers that are all related to needle thoracostomy or chest decompression in the vernacular. And we're going to discuss them each individually, and then we're going to come back and discuss them as a group. So we'll start with Dr. Michael Blevaz. I hope I'm saying that correctly. Inadequate needle thoracostomy rate in the pre-hospital setting for presumed pneumothorax. So just as a way of introduction, the methods for this particular study, a group of emergency department physicians, presumably at a level one trauma center here, it says, in Georgia, happened to, as a sample of convenience, try to determine when a patient had received a needle thoracostomy in the field, whether or not that was effective or not, and whether or not the lung was in fact collapsed. The theory being here that it's kind of common knowledge that, or at least we think it's common knowledge, that anybody who gets decompressed in the field should, upon arrival in the emergency department, get a chest tube. And this study is sort of saying, well, if you get needle decompression, do you really actually collapse a lung? So let's talk a little bit about the findings here. And the findings are somewhat surprising because it does appear that even when a needle goes in, at least I believe it was, you guys can correct me, but about 26% of the time, the 26 of patients who received needle thoracostomy in the pre-hospital setting for a suspected pneumothorax appeared not to have a pneumothorax originally. So if the paramedic who inserted the needle in the first place thought there was a pneumothorax there and tried to decompress the chest, and I should correct it to say they must have thought it was a tension pneumothorax. We don't just decompress a chest for the heck of decompressing a chest. So if they thought there was a tension pneumothorax, they put the needle in, you would have hoped that they would have either relieved the actual tension and maybe re-expanded the lung, and there would be no evidence whatsoever, or there's some evidence of the pneumothorax, but no evidence whatsoever would indicate that either these paramedics were decompressing chests that they didn't need to decompress, and or that when they did, they wouldn't have made a difference. So let's talk a little bit more about this as a group.
Well, I think it's important to recognize that what made these doctors think to do the study was that they were seeing instances where patients were brought in with a needle decompression who, for whatever reason, they elected not to immediately place a chest tube. It's been general practice and general teaching by surgical residents and ER residents that if you have a trauma patient that's come in with a needle decompression, that you don't wait around for chest x-rays. You just go ahead and, you know, you bet that must have been a dropped lung on the field. And if it wasn't, then the needle itself caused the drop field. So let's go ahead and place a chest tube.
And on the pre-hospital side and the educational side, we teach everybody going through PHTLS, ITLS, paramedic school, when you put this in, you will cause a pneumothorax
exactly.
If there isn't one already.
But what these doctors kind of challenged was, you know what, they were having some patients that were hemodynamically stable with the catheter in the chest, and they said, you know what, let's just get a, you know, CT or an x-ray or something, you know, go ahead and do our workup. And they were finding instances where, lo and behold, there was no pneumothorax present. So they said, well, let's study this then. Let's, in the future, when the patients come in, unless there's an obvious reason to stick a chest tube in, let's do an ultrasound or a CAT scan and see what's going on. And they opt for using ultrasound. And lo and behold, they found that a large percentage of their patients that were coming in with these needles in their chest didn't have a pneumothorax. Now, it raises the question, and you mentioned this issue that because for what reason did they have the needle placed in the field? The authors don't tell us.
Yes,
and in fact, they describe one guy here that got three needles in the one side of his chest, only based upon unilateral lack of breath sounds. And on ultrasound, he was found not to have a pneumothorax. And he didn't develop a pneumothorax after being stabbed three times with a 14-gauge angiocath.
Yeah. Come on.
So it really challenges a couple of things that we've been teaching, and that is that if you put a needle on somebody's chest, you're going to give them a pneumo. And maybe we've done that to scare the hell out of EMTs and paramedics to keep them from doing it just in case, only do it absolutely if you need to. But the other thing is, and that's what we can talk about is what is the physiology of putting a needle in somebody's chest? Is there a difference in putting, and these authors don't describe what the conditions of these patients are. Were they all under positive pressure ventilation? Were they all intubated? Were they all being bagged? Or were they all breathing spontaneously? We don't know. And is there a difference in putting a needle in somebody's chest who's breathing spontaneously versus someone who's on positive pressure ventilation?
And that's a great point, Dr. Wesley, because when you think about the physiology of breathing, when you're just breathing room air, it's a negative pressure. Your diaphragm goes down, your chest expands, and you suck the air in. But when we start pushing that air in with BiPAP or an endotracheal tube, or even just bagging the patient with BLS techniques, you can take a very small hole, which may not be a problem when you're breathing normally, and now you're pushing air through that hole. And so you can take a patient with a simple pneumothorax that wouldn't even be detectable in the pre-hospital clinical environment and transition that into a tension pneumo very quickly.
I find this incredibly interesting because in my mind as a paramedic, I think a guy is stabbed with an ice pick, a stab with a knife, a stab with, it's all the same thing. You've penetrated, and I think incorrectly we teach people to think of those lungs as balloons. They're not balloons. They're more sponges, and so you don't just pop the balloon as soon as you touch it with anything sharp. It's sounding more like you can be stabbed and not develop that tension pneumo. So
that's certainly what it appears that they're telling us, but I think we still need more information about the physical parameters of the patients, both at the scene, at the time they received the needle, as well as what their physiologic parameters were at the time of the ultrasound. We don't have that information in this study.
I was really disappointed in a couple of the things that they didn't tell us about these needles, and maybe they didn't know that, but the size of the needle matters, maybe, because we're going to talk about two other papers where that may have been a factor. The location in which those decompressions were performed. So were they anterior, second intercostal space, midclavicular line? Were they midaxillary? We don't know where these were. Or, like you said, are these obese patients with a very short needle? We're missing some information. And the way they collected it was really kind of a sample of convenience. So it's when they were working. If one came in, they were documented. So we don't really kind of have a sense of what the universe was like in terms of a true randomization or true documentation of every single one that came in.
And the biggest thing that I think they left out of this study is they didn't tell us what happens after they put the needle in. If these were patients in shock who were tachycardic, hypoxic, tachypneic, and then you place this
good
needle
point.
And all of a sudden their vital signs fine. Correct. Yeah. I mean, that's a huge piece of information that tells you more than any measurement.
Or transport times. What happens when you actually decompress somebody and it takes a half hour, an hour to get to the receiving center, and by then they actually re-expanded their lung, everything looks absolutely normal. You really don't know if there was an injury there in the first place. Very valid points.
Well, I agree with you. And I think that comes back to the issue of what was the criteria that pre-hospital providers in their system needle to chest. I don't know what other people teach, but what I teach is that, at least for trauma, it's kind of the last thing you do before calling a traumatic code, because often the patients who have blunt chest trauma, their anatomy is so disfigured. They usually have head and facial injuries. So looking for the classic triad of decreased breath sounds, JVD, and tracheal deviation often just simply can't even be observed on the scene of trauma.
That's
so
ridiculous. And
you often wind up just,
about how to recognize those things in the field is in my mind, is the most ridiculous. It comes up in every test question, JVD, tracheal deviation, et cetera. And in truth, they either have a seat collar on, they're obese, they're not sitting at a 45-degree angle. You don't really know if they have JVD. I think tachycardia and shortness of breath are probably the better indicators. And hypotension, if it's truly a tension pneumothorax. If
they exactly. don't have hypotension, why are you needling it? Exactly. And so is this an incrimination of their system in that they've got medics needling spontaneously breathing patients who are simply short of breath? Well, that could be half your COPD patient population is atraumatic.
And I think in the theory of the trauma books, the ITLS, PHTLS theory of you better be safe than sorry. Needle the chest because at worst you're going to cause them a small pneumo. But if you don't, they could die of the tension pneumo. So there's this encouragement to needle somebody's chest if you're in doubt. And that really creates the impression that, well, a lot more people should be needled that maybe need it in the first place. And at least from the authors of this paper or the author of this paper, maybe it isn't such a bad thing when we stick needles in. It actually turns out that quite a bit of the time it didn't do anything at all.
Yeah, as long as you can make sure that the trauma team isn't just going to slap a chest tube in behind
it. Oh, exactly, and put a chest tube in.
Because now you've taken a patient who didn't have a pneumo and you gave him a big pneumo.
And a hospital stay, too.
And a hospital stay and a longer complication rate.
And an infection and anything else, yeah.
Well, so I'm going to go out on a limb here now, guys, and I think I'm going to disagree a little bit because I've been stressing with our providers that they should have a lower threshold to place these needles because tension pneumo kills a lot of people. There's quite a bit of data now coming out of the military that shows that a lot of these combat wounded soldiers, and granted, that's a little bit different. That's usually penetrating trauma, and so I understand that's not completely applicable to the civilian setting, but nonetheless, tension pneumo kills a lot of people, and unrecognized tension pneumo kills a lot of people. And
yeah, this is you're making the argument for needle.
This is the only treatment we got in the back of a rig, and so if you got someone in a cardiac arrest, a traumatic cardiac arrest, you know, you can't kill a dead guy. All you got to offer is hope. And so if you got a tension pneumo that's undiagnosed,
say a little what needle
damage
prayer.
Are you going to cause?
I will not disagree with you, my fine colleague, on that. Because that's what I said. This, you know, the needling the traumatic arrest is kind of the last thing you do before calling it. But the question is, maybe do you do it sooner?
Yeah.
Do you prophylactically,
your
if you've got
threshold?
A hypotensive trauma patient
that
maybe you don't feel like you're bagging them very well, you're feeling the increased compliance, that you should go ahead and needle them? Well, this study would show that, you know what, it probably isn't going to hurt them.
Yeah, I would have loved to have known how many people were actually breathing on their own in this study versus being bagged.
I think
that
would have given us a substantially greater understanding. And so for those listening to us, that's Dr. Burnett is saying needle everything that walks and breathes. And I'm saying do it as a last resort. And Dave
and
doesn't
I'm
know.
Saying, and do more research, way, do more way, research, way do quiet. More research, do more research.
Yeah, Marshall's holding a needle right now.
Yes.
Be afraid.
I don't know. I didn't really care for the study, actually. I thought it was just kind of garbage, personally.
Oh, man. I don't know. Look at the great debate.
Look at the great information
that comes out of this. Did we know that 26% of the time that missed? I'm glad this guy does this research.
Well, okay. Like you said, Dave, you know, this is a convenient sample, and the guy, clearly it was patients that came in that he saw, he charted down a few notes, compiled it all into an Excel spreadsheet, ran some numbers, and oh, voila, I have 57 patients who...
Hey, it's better than what we had before, which was nothing at all.
True. But still, I mean, I think we're giving it too much credence. Like, I think we're just... There's too much... I think... Well, yeah. I just... Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you what.
Isn't that the role
Marshall's
of an observational
gonna do a study?
Study.
a multi-institutional randomized controlled trial, and we'll see. I'll volunteer my chest. You can decompress me, Marshall.
Wonderful.
All right. Let's do a second one of these needle decompression thoracostomy studies, and we'll do Dr. Ball et al., and there's some PHTLS authors on this. Dr. Solomon is on here. Who's one of the authors of the PHTLS textbook. This has a lot better methodology. It's called thoracic needle decompression for tension pneumothorax, clinical correlation with catheter length. And it's in the Canadian Journal of, I believe, surgery. I'll come up with it here in a second. And what they looked at was, again, the size, the length of the needle, and they randomized, well, they didn't randomize. They just took the patients that were being brought in by ground were decompressed with one size needle, and the patients that were coming in by helicopter were decompressed with a longer needle. And the idea being that maybe the shorter needles are not doing the job. They don't actually penetrate the chest wall. So the helicopter crews used a 4.5 centimeter catheter sheath, and the ambulance crews were using a 3.2 centimeter sheath. Now, this is a little bit cleaner in terms of methodology, because it isn't just a sample of convenience. They looked at every patient that had been decompressed within that period of time. And not surprisingly, the helicopter patients get decompressed more often than the ground ambulance. So 74% of the time, those patients were decompressed, 28% of the time by ground, those that that met the criteria. So, and overall, it's only 1.5% of all patients. So it's not a lot of patients here that get decompressed. So the interesting thing is that they sort of talk about these shorter needles not being real effective. That this 28% of the time, the needle that the ground ambulance used was effective 28% of the time, which means a lot of the time it was not effective. So what do you guys think about this one?
Well, I'll jump in, and I had quite a few issues with the definition of tension pneumothorax that they use throughout this paper. It is fundamentally different than the definition that I use in my clinical practice. And in my mind, a tension pneumothorax, it's a pneumothorax that is now causing hemodynamic collapse. You're impeding venous return to the heart. You're dropping your blood pressure. You're getting tachycardic. It's a classic form of obstructive shock. So if you don't have shock, you don't have a tension pneumo. And I'm going to just quote from page 186 from this study, where they talk about most current literature also supports investigating a possible tension pneumothorax with imaging studies before providing definitive tube thoracostomy or chest tube placement in a hemodynamically stable, non-hypoxic patient. And I just disagree that if your patient is hemodynamically stable and they're not hypoxic, they don't have a tension pneumothorax. That's a simple pneumothorax. And we don't needle simple pneumothoraces in the emergency department or in the back of an ambulance.
Good point. But that last statement is the crux, because if we look at the difference between the air versus the ground, the air patients were significantly more likely to be hemodynamically unstable,
yes,
and significantly likely to be intubated.
Yes.
So the question, and their question was, does the presence of the catheter adequately decompress the pneumothorax? Well, if I've got someone under positive pressure ventilation, I'm more likely going to have more pressure. Even though it may not be a tension pneumothorax, it's going to be a higher pressured pneumothorax. And therefore, it seems reasonable that if there's a catheter in that space, it's going to more adequately decompress that pneumo. And so, did that make a difference? So, you know, they're implying that it was that the 4.5 was better at decompressing the 3.2. Really? Did they confirm that the 3.2 actually wasn't in the pleural space? Is that what they're saying? And yet they don't really tell us that on the examination of the CAT scans, because these patients were all hemodynamically stable at the time of the evaluation here, because they did CAT scans on these patients. So what happened to that needle? Did it move? Is it in a different position than it was at the time that it was inserted in the field?
That's a valid thought.
So a lot of things can change.
I hope that they would have told us as well. I had the same concern from the first paper, where we don't know where these were placed. So It's helpful to a certain extent, and we would, you know, make a leap and say there were probably anterior chest decompressions just from their discussion of the mid-axillary decompression. I had to go back, to be quite honest, and look at the size of the needle that's in our bag, because they usually are measured in inches, and we carry a lot of short Jelco 1¼, 1½-inch needle, 14 gauges, but the chest decompression kit that we have is a 10-gauge needle with a 3-inch catheter sheath. And I remember when we switched to those.
That's 3 inches. That's 8 centimeters.
Yeah.
Go home.
That's a lance. Okay.
You're not going to miss anything.
And we only go
that's
anterior.
That's the house of God needle.
Right.
There's no body cavity that can't be reached with a 10-gauge spinal needle and a strong arm.
And I seriously doubt that we would ever have a problem creating a tension pneumo with a 10-gauge, 3-inch catheter.
Not to mention a coronary artery laceration. No kidding.
Now, the reason we carry those is I can remember the case, and that was an obese patient who was struck by a train, and no needle that the ground ambulance or the helicopter, which incidentally couldn't transport the patient because they ended up being too big for the helicopter, but no one carried a needle that would have decompressed her, and she died because of it. And so we elected to go with a bigger needle and a longer sheath. And then we cannot absolutely miss. So I do have to say, I went back and kind of thought, okay, I did think that my little 1¼ would be just fine to do this with, and maybe not. Well, let's do the final one, and then we'll kind of tie what they all say about each other together. This is Dr. McLean, Rob McLean, et al., and it's ultrasound determination of chest wall thickness, implications for needle thoracostomy. And it's out of the American Journal of Emergency Medicine. By the way, the previous one was out of the Canadian Journal of Surgery, so that I just wanted to confirm that. So this is a little bit of more of an ultrasound study to just check chest wall thickness, and their findings are interesting. They were trying to determine whether or not a catheter length of less than 4.5 centimeters would actually penetrate most chest walls. And what they found here was that, in fact, there are very few patients that have a chest wall thickness that exceeds 4.5 centimeters. So they conclude that a needle that's 4.5 centimeters or smaller is going to be an adequate needle to decompress a chest. So what do you guys think about this one?
I thought it was an interesting study. It certainly asks a question that kind of gets at the heart of everything we're talking today, is how big a needle do you need to get the job done? I certainly think not many of us would disagree that a 3-inch, 10-gauge needle will get the job done. But the question posed by this paper, I think, is a very appropriate one.
You know, I looked at the study and looking at all three of them, I thought this was interesting. But this one specifically kind of caught my eye. And if you look at the objective, and I feel like the bearer of bad news, but it states that computed tomography, or CT, measurements of chest wall thickness suggest that the standard length of angiocatheters, 4.5 centimeters, may fail to decompress tension pneumothoraces. Yet they used ultrasound to compare, to look at this number. So my question is ultrasound measurement equivalent to CT measurement?
That's an excellent question. I hadn't even picked up on that.
If mom says no, just go ask dad.
Yeah. these ultrasounds were not performed by radiologists. They were performed by emergency medicine physicians. I'm not saying there's a difference in their training, but...
Yeah.
But could the calibration of the it's a very good question. Is the measurement of chest wall thickness on a CT more or less accurate and does it agree with ultrasound?
Oh, interesting. I was tickled by, I think there was a poster at another paper, another project at ASEP that looked at the use of ultrasound and training EMTs and paramedics to use ultrasound in, I think, a 4-hour or less training, which was done here locally by Hennepin County Medical Center, but for different reasons, not for chest decompression. But put it all together, and it seems like ultrasound may not be that difficult of a skill to pick up and may be very useful in trying to figure out if you have a pneumothorax or not, regardless of chest wall thickness. But the issue of, whether it compares to CT and how thick, that's a good one. I'm not sure.
Yeah, well, I mean, just think about it, Darren. When you're doing an ultrasound on the chest, you have to take that transducer. You do have to push it down onto the chest wall to get a good signal to go through the chest and visualize the pleura. If you put it down too lightly, you get artifact and you don't get a good signal. So is that compression? I mean, if we're talking the difference between, 1 centimeter, not a lot.
You're probably pushing more compressing something.
I can push I can just push my thumb on into your chest wall a centimeter just to get to the rib. So,
very good point.
I think Marshall really brings up an interesting point. Just did they use a transducer that they simply just laid on the chest using its own weight and it didn't compress the skin at all? They don't describe.
And I think another great point. One of the papers, I believe, the second paper talked a little bit about decompressing patients that had. That were obese or possibly had, I think they mentioned something like tactical gear, body armor, not that you would want to penetrate through the body armor to decompress it. You'd assume that you would take all that stuff off. But it does beg the question, bigger people, what percentage of the population walks around with, some of that weight? And I know I had a bigger lady that just had a large chest. Most of the body fat was just up there, and it was difficult to figure out when they're supine, and they're, in particular, her breasts and her chest were all creating a rather big mass of tissue. It's hard to figure out how deep to go to actually get through there.
And, I thought there was another interesting question in this article. They looked at what was the thickness of the chest wall laterally, so in the mid-axillary line, versus anteriorly in the mid-clavicular line. And this has always been a question I've thought a lot about because I have this recurring nightmare that I'm decompressing a left-sided pneumothorax and being decompressed. And for whatever reason, everyone's panicking and they do the needle decompression too low and that needle goes right into the heart. Well, you do that laterally, and I don't care if you're using a 3-inch needle. You're probably not going to hit the heart unless you're trying. So I've always wondered, would it be better to do these needle decompressions laterally? And this paper looked at that, and they found that the lateral chest wall was actually thicker than the anterior. And so that kind of went against what I was thinking, and it certainly argues that we are doing these in the right position, the mid-clavicular line, second intercostal space.
Yeah, in the old days, I think when we were using McSwain darts, we kept hearing about livers that got lacerated and spleens that got lacerated because we were coming in off the side with, the McSwain dart is probably 6 inches. It was an enormous animal. And I have great respect for Dr. McSwain, and that tool was something I proudly learned to use. And then I, later on sort of started to question. It certainly points us in the anterior direction. So, if we were to summarize these three papers and put them together, I think what strikes you the most? We don't always decompress when we thought we decompressed.
So I think that's correct. The other thing I would say is these papers kept talking about chest x-rays, but in the pre-hospital realm, and I would argue in the ED, who cares if you got some air on the chest x-ray? If you have someone in shock, you dart their chest, and all of a sudden they're stabilizing, that's the goal. So to any budding researchers out there, I'd recommend you do a similar paper like this, but don't look at chest x-rays, don't look at ultrasounds, just look at how often the vital signs normalize after a pre-hospital provider does a needle thoracostomy.
Interesting. Good points. And I think a takeaway point would be what size needle would you put in your drug bag today? And I think based on these three, you'd say a minimum of 4.5 centimeters.
I think that's appropriate. If you look at some of the references, particularly in this last one American Journal of Emergency Medicine, the thing that raised this up was the CT findings and some autopsy findings where they were seeing lacerations, coronary artery lacerations with longer needles. Now, the question is, did that happen because people without attention? Because if you've got attention pneumothorax, then the heart ought not to be that close to the chest wall. Or did they needle it and leave the needle in too long, and as the tension pneumothorax was decompressing, it rubbed up against the needle? Teaching has always been: you put the needle in it, and you listen for the air rushing out. If I could hear the air rushing out, then I would have been able to tell whether or not I really had decreased lung sounds when I was listening. So forget that. So maybe part of the issue is in our training is, one, don't be as afraid as we thought we were about needling a chest. But when you do needle the chest, that as soon as you get it into the chest deep enough, pull the needle out. It's not like you're going to go in there and wait for something. It's either in or it's not. And you don't, so are you only going to go halfway in and then you wait for the air? Generally, it's all or none. I don't think anyone's ever said, well, let's just slowly put this needle in until we get a release of air. Oh, I got a release of air after only, half the catheter's in.
Yeah,
nobody
no.
does that. They,
either
it's all or none.
You put,
yeah, you go home or, go big or go home, as Aaron said.
All right. Any parting other thoughts about these three? I think we'll all go back to our drug box. We'll all make sure that we're actually hemodynamically unstable before we stick a needle in there. But don't be so afraid, I guess the message is, because they could die if you misrecognize it or don't recognize it or don't do anything about it, even if you suspect it. And it might not be as sure of a thing. And if there are any physicians out there, watch out who you're putting chest tubes in, please. All right, thanks for tuning in for another edition of this PCRF podcast.